Okay, Eleanor, welcome.
Thank you.
And we just had a very nice meal before we came here, and that's also something I would like to mention, a little advertisement for our cafe downstairs. I had a wonderful cocktail. It's called Icarus, and it was inspired by a painting of Lee Krasner. So if you feel like you need a cocktail after this talk and after this film, you should definitely go down to Badia's and get the Icarus cocktail. It's really, really nice, a little bit sweet, but you should definitely try it. Eleanor, so to start with, do you remember when you first saw a work by Lee Krasner?
It's a good question, and I don't, is the honest. And it's now on the wall at Tate Modern, and we actually didn't borrow it for this show precisely because I felt that that was where it needed to remain. But I think that's only been up in their collection displays for probably the last 6 or 7 years. It's relatively recently that museums have really been wanting to highlight her work in collection displays. So it's hard for me to pinpoint when I first saw her work, but I do remember the first moment when I thought, we have to do this show, which was one of those kind of lovely serendipitous moments when I was in Malaga, and there's a lovely little Picasso museum in Malaga. I don't know if anyone's been there. And they have slightly strange programming, to be honest, but they had a small exhibition which was ostensibly about Pollock. It was about Pollock's mural. And as some of you may know, there's been a huge research project around Pollock's mural, which has been going on for about 5 years now, where they've done an enormous amount of conservation research, you know, unpicking all these myths. Peggy Guggenheim always said this was a painting that was made in one night. These conservators have gone in and said there's absolutely no way this was made in one night. So they had a display about that, and they chose to show some other artists who were influenced by Pollock's work. And they had as part of this display a couple of things by Lee Krasner, but the main work was a large-scale painting called Another Storm. Can we just ask how many people here, there's no judgment, have seen the show? Just so we have a sense. Okay, so a few people have, but some people haven't, just so we have an idea. So there is a very, very large painting, the largest painting in the show. It's called Another Storm, and it's made almost exclusively in alizarin crimson. And it really takes you. I mean, partly because the sheer scale of it means that you are immediately immersed in this painterly landscape. And I was just kind of completely blown away by it, but also simultaneously blown away and then appalled that this work was purely there as an illustration of Pollock's influence, and I felt that there was something incredibly wrong about this.
It's very interesting what you mentioned, because in Great Britain and in Germany we have the same situation. Also here there's only one work in a public collection. It's in the Museum Ludwig in Cologne. And also when we look at our work list or checklist for the exhibition, it's very telling that there's one work from Switzerland, one from Great Britain.
Almost nothing from Europe.
That's it. The rest is from American collections. And I have to tell you that it's the same for me. I saw her work, well, not in Malaga, but in the United States, in New York, in a very small exhibition that was called Pathmakers. And that was in the Museum of Arts and Design in New York. And it was like a combination of different female artists who works in crafts and art and painting. And her work really stood out. It was very interesting, but this was long before we did this show. But it was very interesting that you talked about Another Storm, because that was such a complicated work for us, also at the Barbican, right? Like positioning it in the exhibition, because it's so strong. Maybe you can give, since this exhibition was your idea, you then came to us and asked us if we want to collaborate, and you also asked the Zentrum Paul Klee in Bern, and then also the Guggenheim Bilbao, so that we got this amazing tour. But you were definitely the person who chose the works. So maybe you can give the audience a little insight on how you do this. Like you said, okay, the Krasner is amazing, I want to do a show. How do you start with that?
So we thought we'd talk a bit about process, by the way, guys, but just because we were talking earlier about what we might talk about, and we were like, the thing that you can't get anywhere else is the kind of behind the scenes stuff from curators. But we're also really keen for questions. So we're going to talk a bit, but do think of questions as we're going. So I guess the answer to that is that I really start by trying to, and I know you have a very similar process, but just get as close to the artist as possible. So I normally make a research file with, first of all, every interview I can get hold of that they've ever done. That might be video, it might be transcripts of interviews, it might be, you know, there's a doctoral student who went and interviewed her, never finished their dissertation, but managed to get that interview. Anything you can find where she's speaking about her history, her work, because you want to understand, what did she think was important? What were the real breaking points for her? What were the turning points? I suppose the next thing is that you have to think about the space. And I think you have many different types of curators. And one thing that I'm always conscious of is there's a big risk when you're in an early stage of exhibition making that you make a book and then you think you can put it on the walls, i.e. you make something that's a really great narrative and then you illustrate it on the walls rather than really think spatially about how you're telling a story and how you're unraveling it. So one of the things that I was very excited about with Lee Krasner is the fact that she moves through these cycles. So she doesn't have this signature style. She thinks basically that that's quite a corrupt way of working. She wants to immerse herself in one idea, one body, and then it breaks, and then she goes into something completely different and starts doing collage or whatever else. And for anyone who's been to the Barbican Centre, we are a brutalist building. We are made of concrete. There are some spaces of flexibility, and there's an awful lot that is not flexible. And so you have to tell a story in chapters. And so to have an artist where there's already this sense of chapters built into them works really well. You know, there are a lot of artists who I'm really excited by, but I just know they wouldn't be right for our space because you want one beautiful, grand, open hall and you want everything to just be visually in dialogue. We can't really do that in that way. So the next thing was to sort of think, okay, well, if we're telling the story in chapters, what should the chapters be? And I looked very closely at her first major survey show as an exhibition in 1965 at the Whitechapel Gallery in London. And as you know, she was really close with Brian Robertson, who was the director then and was this kind of completely visionary figure. He also did a Rothko show. He pretty much bankrupted the gallery doing this. When I was going through their archives, there are all these letters from lenders being like, could you send our painting back? And all these assistant curators being like, we're ever so sorry, we're doing the fundraising at the moment. As soon as we've got the money, we'll send the painting back.
Very different process you know, than
very
now.
Very different age of exhibition making. But he had these grand ambitions. And he worked really intimately with her on this show. So I was interested in the fact that there are certain periods of work that she made in the 30s, for instance, which we don't include in this show, which she didn't include, and I have my ideas about why she chose not to highlight those certain moments. You know, it's a 50-year career, and she made, the catalogue Resonné contains 599 works of paintings and works on paper, etc., which is generally considered relatively small, but there's got to be a major process of selection. So I guess my answer is really look to her wherever you can.
What I found very interesting is that you also included the early works, or a lot of the early works actually, which differs this exhibition from a lot of others. I mean, in a lot of retrospective where you have such a rich work like hers, the early work is like, oh yeah, that's the student work. We don't need to show this because it's not like it's not her full developed style. And I know that this section was very dear to your heart, so maybe you can tell a little bit more about why you chose to include this and how the visitors also benefit from this.
So I think some of that's probably about a shift in thinking about what exhibition making is. Like, what are we setting out to do when we do an exhibition? And particularly when we're doing a monographic show, when this is one artist, and in this instance, you know, the first ever large-scale show in Germany, the first large-scale show in the UK in 50 years, you know, that's quite a lot of sort of like pressure on you. And I suppose in the past, the thinking has just been get in the big works. You know, so when the Whitney did a show in 1973, which was also a really important moment for her, Marcia Tucker, who was another amazing curator, staged that show. It was literally called Lee Krasner : large works. I mean, they weren't even hiding it. And I think now, I suppose I'm really interested in narrative and storytelling in relation to exhibitions, because I think that's a lot of what we come to exhibitions for, is to kind of learn and be immersed in this moment of history and to be told stories about that time. And I think understanding something of an artist's development is really key. So you want to be sensitive about it. So like I say, you know, there are some periods of her work where obviously she too thought, you know, this isn't necessarily what I'd want to hang on a wall, or this is something that's not fully kind of developed or fleshed out. So you want to be sensitive about that. But early room in the show here, in which we show some of the life drawings. And the life drawings, to my knowledge, had never really been included in any of the large-scale exhibitions to date. But they tell us so much about both formally who she was as an artist and how she was working. And I also looked a lot, you know, she studies with Hans Hofmann at this really important point in the late 1930s. She really seeks him out as a kind of tutor of modernism. She wants somebody who's going to be teaching her some more radical ideas. And I looked quite closely at some of her classmates and what their drawings look like, and they're very, very different, you know, so you get a sense of her sort of artistic identity that she's forming for herself. But there's also a lot of cultural history in them. So you're thinking about this young woman who's grown up in an Orthodox Jewish Russian emigre home, and there she is drawing men in the nude in the, you know, in the 1930s. And I think that's a really important part of the story as well, that if we want to get to grips with what made Lee Krasner Lee Krasner, we need to have some understanding of who and where she was.
The other benefit we have from this section, I think, is also that we can think about the way how we see American art. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that a couple of times when we had the press conference, that we see these life drawings, these charcoal drawings, the very cubic, like they deal with cubism, and you look at the date on the label and you're like, 1938? Cubism is dead since 20 years. But that's a very European perspective. And so I like this section a lot, because you can really learn, like, to widen your perspective and to learn, like, remember that European avant-garde was not very known in the United States. The MoMA opens in 1929. Before that, it was not very present, and these young artists just looked at black and white photographs of Cézanne, Matisse, and Picasso. Mm. And Hoffman was, in fact, the only one who taught cubism in his class. Otherwise, it was a very academic tradition. Krasner and other and her contemporaries were growing up as artists. Mm. Since I saw that a lot of you haven't seen the show yet, I also would like to dig a little bit more into her life. Mm. I think, and you already mentioned that, her background. I found it always very fascinating that she came from this very tight, very strict environment. As you mentioned, her parents were Russian Jewish immigrants, and they're very, very strict. They're very strong believers, and somehow she managed to grow out of this without somehow breaking up with her parents. There was never a real damage in this relationship. And it's also interesting that she was never really able to define how the idea to become an artist came up into her mind, but it came up very early on. So maybe you can talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've got ideas on it too, because there's no...
Yeah, we can share those.
Yeah, because there's no definitive answer in a way. And we should say that one of the things that's nice about when you do a project like this is you can sometimes kind of help along other projects in tandem as well. So There was a biography of Krasner that was published, I think around 2007, 2008, by Gail Levin. And it had an American imprint, but it had never been published. It wasn't available in Europe. And it's been republished to coincide with the show. So if you're interested in more about her life, it is a kind of amazing book. And likewise, Mary Gabriel has just published this extraordinary book called Ninth Street Women, which retells the entire story of abstract expressionism, but from the perspectives of five women artists. So it's Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Helen Frankenthaler, Grace Hartingen, and Joan Mitchell. And it's an absolute joy. And I mean, to give you an idea, Amazon have just bought the rights to make it into a television series. So it's really kind of gripping stuff and told in this very cinematic way. So these are kind of amazing stories. And I think one of the things I was very conscious of, and one of the driving forces actually for wanting to do this show, was that somehow abstract expressionism became this very white male American story. And that's such a mistelling of what was going on. You know, if you think of how many extraordinary figures, each with their own often quite traumatic stories, Arshil Gorky or Mark Rothko. I mean, can anyone here pronounce Mark Rothko's actual name? I mean, they're all inventing themselves anew in this place. Even Jackson Pollock is Paul Pollock. People forget that. Jackson is his middle name. You know, it's a great moment of reinvention for these artists in the US. And she's, one of the things I think that's very relevant is she's the first child in her family to be born in the US. So she has younger siblings who are born after her. She has these older siblings, including an older brother who's very influential on her. You know, she's like reading Edgar Allan Poe with him at like the age of 11. But she's the first in the US. And I think that she talks about having this American identity, and even the fact that she chooses to rename herself. You know, she's born Lena, and then she chooses to become Lenore, which again, Edgar Allan Poe. And then she adopts this moniker of Lee, which of course is quintessentially American and also androgynous and has these other kind of overtones. So I think she always has this sense of, I can make myself who I want to be. And she's, well, you know, you'll see, we talk about it a little bit in the show and in greater depth in the catalogue, these ideas about self-invention and just this extraordinary spirit. I mean, you really feel it in the work. And the reason why it's so fun to show films like the one we'll show tonight is because the minute she starts speaking, I mean, she's just hilarious and she kind of knocks you sideways. But she clearly had this spirit very young. And, you know, she talks about when she was a teenager and she was taught to read Hebrew, but she was taught to write Hebrew, but she was never taught to read it. And the moment at which she started to really understand what was being said about women in Jewish scripture, and she says, you know, that started up a revolution that I never recovered from. And, you know, she describes herself coming back to her family home like a banshee. And, you know, she really gets incredibly sort of fired up about this. And I think she never loses that spirit. And I think that's what you kind of feel there persistently throughout the work. And also courage. And one of the things that often when I walk around the show with artists, it's easy for us to become a little bit glib when we talk about things like, she destroyed a lot of work. She was a ruthless editor of her own work, which of course is partly very practical. She didn't sell a huge amount of work in her lifetime. She didn't have a lot of storage space. So some of that's very practical. But some of it was also who she was as an artist. And you know, you speak to artists when there's a body of collages that we show that is made of torn up drawings and former paintings all brought back together, and they're like, the idea for them of being able to attack their own work in that way, they have physical reactions to that, you know. So I think you really feel that spirit the whole way through.
I absolutely love that you used the word courage, because that's really what you feel in a lot of the works. And I had a journalist here the last days, and he said about the collage, it feels a little bit like it's like better failing. Like she took this failure and created, like made something entirely new, entirely better out of this. Mm. And this is something that reappears in her work. Like, she is in situations that are very difficult. The Prophecy series is a perfect example for that. And she really creates something new. Do you want to talk about the Prophecy series for a little bit?
Do you want to talk about the Prophecy series? Why don't you? You tell me.
I can also talk a little. Or you can ask me a question if you want. Well, the Prophecy series, for those who have been in the show, have seen it, is the series that is created around Pollock's death. And that's the perfect moment for us to talk about the famous husband. Because that was a challenge in the show as well, like how to deal with him, because we couldn't say, oh, we denied that he existed, but we also didn't want to give him too much room, because especially in former shows, it was always like the wife of Jackson Pollock, and then a lot of comparing their works and so on. But it is, you can't deny him, he is a very important part in her life. And especially in the Prophecy series, you can feel that and sense that. Mm. And so the series was created around his death. The work Prophecy, she actually finished before his death. He saw it, they talked about it, they disagreed about it, actually. And then she left it on her easel and left for Paris for a trip they actually planned to do together. But he was in a rather complicated state, so he didn't join her for this trip. And she spent a couple of weeks in Paris and went to the French countryside. And then she got the phone call that he died in this very famous car accident. And when she came back, with all this trauma inside of herself, this painting was on her easel. And she always said that from the moment she finished it, she was terrified by it. But then, instead of like putting it away or doing something entirely different, she worked with this and created an entire series of four works that we also present in the show. And I think it's the first time they have ever been presented together. Mm. And so this is a very, again, you can see like from how she uses situations like that that are very complicated and devastating to create.
Mm. Just on the Pollock side note, because I think it's funny, one of the things when I was thinking about how much to talk or not talk about Pollock, one of the exercises that I used to do, I don't know if I told you this, was I used to think about Albers, and I'd think, okay, imagine you're doing a show about Albers and you're writing a text. Would you say, Albers moved to Connecticut with Annie? Or would you just say, Albers moved to Connecticut? You know, like you have, there are many moments where it really is relevant to talk about him. You know, for instance, and we've spoken about this a lot, one of the things that sometimes gets conflated is this idea that when she says, she says very openly, he was one of the biggest artistic influences on me. She's not saying, I looked at his imagery and I thought, that imagery is good. I'll do imagery like that imagery. She's saying, he was the first person who legitimized for me the idea that everything that I am inside is worthy of this canvas. You know, all of the traditional teaching that Ilka was speaking about, all of that academy that had taught her, here is your easel, here is your landscape, set about trying to depict it on this, became, what is my inner landscape? And de Kooning famously says he broke the ice for all of us, because the history of abstract expressionism is these artists who realized that they needed to look inward. But I just think that it's interesting how much even those of us who are working so intimately on these subjects have to find ways to check ourselves. And there's a nice thing that came out of us doing the show in London, which is that this one work that I mentioned, Gothic Landscape, that's on show in Tate Modern, is in a room that also has a Pollock work in it. And on Twitter, various people had pointed out that in the little label that's next to Krasner's work, it mentions that she's the wife of Jackson Pollock. But in the little label next to Jackson Pollock's work, it does not say that he's the husband of Lee Krasner. And they've changed it. You know, it's such a simple thing to change. And just because of social media, and you think, that's such a nice thing that, you know, there are so many micro things that come out of staging a show like this, and that's one of them.
That's actually great that they did it, because I remember when we talked about the Abstract Expressionism show 2016, you know, you have in mind what the label said, so maybe you want to share that with the audience.
Well, this was a kind of, it was quite an important moment in London in recent years. I don't know if anyone saw it, but there was a major show about abstract expressionism that was staged at the Royal Academy, and then it traveled to the Guggenheim Bilbao. And in many ways, it was an extraordinary show. I mean, I think there was something like 160 paintings in that show, and works by Clifford Still and artists who you so rarely get to see, some amazing things. And the way that they'd organized the rooms, there were a series of rooms that were thematic, and then there were a series of kind of one-person rooms within the show so that you could have those kind of highlight moments. You had one room of de Kooning, one of Clifford Still, one of Barnett Newman, one of Jackson Pollock. And Lee Krasner's The Eye is the First Circle, which we include in this show, which is a real highlight from her Umber series or Night Journey paintings, was included in the Jackson Pollock room. And the label next to the painting said, "This is a testament of what one woman could paint in the height of her grief for the loss of a genius."
I will not add anything to this because this is just too awful. Well, I mean, there's one thing I also want to talk with you, because before we turn to the film and to questions, of course, yesterday we said a couple of times in the press conference that this cause, a lot of works in this exhibition come from private collections. I mean, I think more than 90% come from the US. That's one thing. We don't have many works of her by her in Europe. We have one work from Australia, which was a huge thing for all of us.
But you've really made the most of that. It's the poster campaign. It's the combat painting.
Yeah, the combat painting. As a visitor, you sometimes walk through an exhibition, you look at the labels and you see, this is Centre Pompidou, that's the Museum of Modern Art. But often you see this little word, private collection, and you don't think so much about it maybe, but for us, this is really a very, very hard thing. This is now the second venue. It will have four venues entirely. So it's London, Barbican in London, the Schön in Frankfurt, the Zentrum Paul Klee in Bern, and then Bilbao. So the works will be on tour for more than a year, almost 1.5 years. And so when you look at the labels and you see how many things come from private collections, you can only just imagine how much work went into this, and I have to give you credit for that because you did the most of that. I mean, we joined forces for a couple of those, but maybe you can give our audience a little insight into this process and what that means, and also who are the people who collect these works? Yeah. What is their relationship to Krasner?
So I do think it's an interesting thing to talk about, because I don't think it gets talked about that much, actually, like that aspect of how you put together an exhibition. And, you know, one of the first challenges is just how do you find these things? You know, so with Krasner, I mentioned there's a catalogue Resonné, and that's a wonderful starting point. But in our instance, that catalogue Resonné was done in 1996. So it's very considerably out of date. It gives you maybe some starting point of where something once was. Now, even that doesn't necessarily help if it tells you that it was owned by an oil baron in Texas. So finding out where it is, then getting to that person. And then I think in Europe, we continue to have what I sometimes call a connoisseurial model of collecting in mind. And it is something that really persists here, which is a very beautiful thing, which is that collectors regard themselves as custodians for an artwork. They are not an owner of it. They are there as a guardian. And therefore, their prime responsibility is to take care of that work and think of the artist's best interests. If the show is in their interest, then they too should support that. And while that definitely does exist in parts of the US, and there are certainly collectors for whom that's true, there are very different kinds of financial principles in the US. I mean, even in terms of the fact that sometimes works are being bought as investments, and sometimes that's not an individual's investment, sometimes that's a financial group of 14 people, and all of them have to unanimously sign off on this to be able to enable it to be lent. So it's quite complicated, and I suppose the thing that really gives me heart about it is I come with very little collateral. So in the instance of an institution, the Barbican doesn't have a collection. I can promise you no exchange.
Same here.
Yeah, same with the Schoen. We cannot say, you lend this painting to us and we will lend this painting to you for a future exhibition. So that's one problem. We offer no financial incentives, so we don't pay loan fees in exchange for these works. So that's another problem.
Same here again.
and so then you're sort of saying, well, why does someone do it? And really the only thing you can turn up with is an enormous amount of energy and passion for what you're doing. And I suppose the thing that gives me heart is I think that still works. Like, not absolutely not in every single instance, but in an awful lot of instances, if you can get in front of someone, and we work in a world now in which, you know, curators are burdened with just such an enormous amount of work and an enormous amount of administration. So it becomes increasingly difficult for us to actually travel and get in front of people. I think you are the same, have a very old-fashioned model. I do very, very little when it comes to loans by email, almost nothing actually, you know, so it becomes just about meeting people and spending time with them and getting to know them and talking to them and trying to find a way to get them to the Barbican, to get them to see the space. And where you can, giving them a sense of the public, because ultimately we don't do this for our personal enrichment. You know, you do it for the 70 or 80,000 people who are going to have an opportunity to stand in front of these works and experience them and understand something about the artist that they didn't know.